Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature novelist Min Jin Lee. When writers are very famous, it can be easy to think that they've always been so. Lee's debut, Free Food for Millionaires, was published in 2007, and a decade later she published Pachinko. Both were blockbuster, best-selling literary novels, and both were lauded by reviewers and honored with accolades across the world. But behind these headlines is a story of an artist who, at first, was uncertain in her vocation, who struggled with self-doubt, and who worked tirelessly to refine her craft. After all, when Lee published her first book, she was already 39. What you're going to hear on this episode is an incredibly honest accounting of how Lee became a writer. From her time as a child in Queens, New York, when she was a new immigrant who did not speak the language, through navigating elite colleges as an outsider, to persevering through a debilitating illness and a career in law that threatened to overwhelm her artistic ambitions. Remarkably, she recounts all this adversity and struggle with great humility, insight, and humor. Here's Lee.
Did you see my name in lights? Wait till my mom sees. I can't believe it. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Could you imagine if you didn't? It would have sucked. So I really appreciate it. Now, for those of you who don't know, I don't have an MFA, and I majored in history. So I didn't major in English or literature. So for those of you who paid very good money to be here tonight, I'm not trained as a writer. So you might as well stay, because it's raining outside. However, I did very much go to inexpensive community-based organization classes, very much like literary arts. So today, when I had the great fortune of meeting authors and writers, I felt very much a strong sense of kinship. Literary communities are made up of independent-minded people like us who gather to seek the truth, and we shape narrative of meaning, and we empower those who are disempowered. But what we are doing tonight is really fellowship, so I want to thank you for supporting literary arts, and I hope that you will continue to do so. Thank you. I've been researching Portland because this is what I do. And those of you who are here, you weren't here when they first started to settle here in Portland. Those who were originally here were the Chinook people and also the Multnomah people, as well as the Clackamas. And they were here when the settlers from Europe and as well as from the East Coast came out here. And those of you who know, Portland is obviously named after Portland, Maine. And it is a kind of New England city, apparently. It's considered a scion of two New England cities, Boston and Portland, Maine, of all places. And it was only incorporated in 1851, which means that Portland is a very young city. It's barely 170 years old. And the reason why I mentioned this is because I was thinking about it a great deal today when I went to see the amazing students of Franklin High School. And because I teach at Amherst College, I teach young people very much, only a year or two, much older than the students here in the high school. I thought to myself, what did the high school students need to know in the era of climate change, in the era of mass shootings, in the era of housing inequity, of education debt? And I thought I should tell them what I know from being 51 years old. It can get better. And it can get better if we deeply, deeply care. The people, the indigenous people of Oregon, were in many ways mistreated and eradicated, and their land was stolen. And we are here today on stolen ground. And I want to acknowledge that. I want to acknowledge that because it's so very important. And then the other ugly part of Portland, which I am here to talk about, and for very briefly, I know you're gonna love this, is during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, a Democratic president, signed Executive Order 9066, and 3,676 people of Japanese descent were gathered in what was called then the Pacific International Livestock Exposition. And the Pacific International Livestock Exposition was a very large place, and it was created in order to show livestock and to grade livestock and to trade livestock. Today, that place is called the Portland Expo Center, and it's only about 6 miles away. And between the months of May through September 1942, the government processed, and by processed, it means it brought people of Japanese ancestry, and about 70% in terms of a federal number, of the 110,000 Japanese people, or people of Japanese descent, 70% of the 110,000 were actually American citizens. And in Portland, 3,676 were brought to the Portland Expo Center, and they were confined there in former animal corrals. And they were stationed there. And then later on, they were sent by train to internment camps. And they lost their property, their friends, and their way of life. General John DeWitt, who was known for his stance against the Japanese in this country, or people of Japanese descent, he said Portland was the first Jap-free city on the West Coast. Now, why do I say this? It is not to endear myself to you, clearly. I say this because I want the high school students to know that it has gotten better. And we can talk about it in this country. And that I'm allowed to talk about it without getting into trouble. And this is a value that is most precious to all of us, for those of us who believe in democracy. And then, although I am an independent person, and although I am a Democrat, I can talk about a Democratic president who did atrocious things. And this is a value that I really want to share with the high school students. You are here because you were kind enough to read Pachinko. And I thought that I would talk a little bit about the formation of my career. And it really began in high school. When I was in high school, over 3 decades ago, 2 things happened to me which separated me from my peers. First, I fell in love with the novels of the American writer Sinclair Lewis, who wrote, among many, many, many other books, he wrote Main Street, my favorite, Aerosmith, Babbitt, and the very timely novel today, It Can't Happen Here. Second, I donated blood to the American Red Cross, and I learned that I was a chronic hepatitis B carrier. So consequently, as a girl, I learned two really important things about me. I admired great old fiction that none of my friends read. And I carried an illness in my body, communicable through blood and sex and through childbirth. So, about Sinclair Lewis. He was a doctor's son, and he was the third son, and his father didn't like him. He was skinny, and he suffered from terrible acne. He was very odd, and he had few friends. So, of course, I identified with him because I was tall, and I was odd, and I didn't have any friends. Anyway, he went to Yale College. So I wanted to go to Yale College because he had gone there. And I applied. And somehow I got in. And I know this sounds crazy, but when I got there, I sort of expected him to be there. He was not, because he had graduated in 1908. Anyway, even though I loved fiction so much that I chose a college based upon my favorite writer at the time, I knew that I would major in economics, because this seemed like a sound thing to do when you grow up in Elmhurst, Queens, and your parents work for 6 days a week in a tiny little store in Manhattan that was underheated and had rats in the basement. So if you wanted to go to the bathroom, you'd have to stamp, and the rats would just look at you. Like, this is my house. That's how rats talk in New York. I didn't want to work in that store when I graduated from college. So my freshman year, I took macroeconomics. And I learned that I can't read graphs. At all. Like, I have no idea why you have a relationship between guns and butter. So I considered, you know, maybe history, because that sounded serious. And I just considered that, well, it's just a bunch of true stories, so how hard could that be? I knew I could never major in English because the girls at Yale who majored in English had amazing hair. And super long eyelashes. And they had beautiful clothes. And I didn't stand a chance. So I think I took a few writing classes and actually won some prizes, but it never occurred to me that I could be a writer. Now, why is that? Well, because in my mind, writers were people like Sinclair Lewis. I was born in South Korea. English was my second language. And in the late 80s, when I was in college, I decided that I would take an Asian American literature class just to figure out if there were any Asian American writers. I didn't know of a single Korean American writer then. And when I took the class, in the syllabus, there were two Korean-American women who had written novels. So the first one I read was by an author named Teresa Hakyung Cha, who wrote a wonderful book called Dictée. It's incredibly innovative and smart, and it's still read today. And immediately after she published the book, she was murdered in 1982. We still don't know what happened. They haven't caught the person who killed her. And then I read another novel, a historical novel called Clay Walls by Run Young Kim. And immediately after she published her book, she died of cancer. So, for Korean American women, if you wrote a novel, you died. I declared my major in history. Now, the second thing that I brought up earlier about my high school years was that I was a hepatitis B chronic carrier. And in high school, I was asymptomatic. And in college, it turned out that I would get very, very ill. And my doctor at Yale New Haven Hospital said that I would get liver cancer in my 20s or in my early 30s. My parents were working the day that I went to go see the doctor, and I'd gone to the hospital by myself. And I remember listening to Dr. Rubin say these things, and the only thing that I thought was, I had to be very careful with my time. Before I graduated from college, I attended a lecture featuring an American missionary, a nice white man who had gone to Japan to help the poor Korean people who were living there. And no one I knew wanted to go to the lecture. So when I was asked by the university chaplain to attend, I said yes. And I went there, and it was me, the speaker, the university chaplain, and one other student. I could not leave. But there were a lot of cookies. And I could have at least 25% of them. I stayed. The gentleman, who was a very good and kind man who served the poor, told us a great deal about the history of Koreans in Japan, and it's a history I knew nothing about. I was 19 years old, and at the time, although I found him really interesting, I was more concerned about the horrible man that I was dating at the time. And I thought to myself, TikTok, like, I want this to wrap up. And then he told a story about a 13-year-old boy who had climbed up to his apartment building and he had jumped off to his death. And the 13-year-old boy was ethnically Korean and he was born in Japan. His parents were also ethnically Korean, and they were born in Japan. The parents had no idea that their 13-year-old son had planned something so unspeakably sad. So in order to understand their son's actions, they went through all of his things, and in his things, they found his middle school yearbook. His middle school yearbook. He had just graduated. And in the middle school yearbook, his Japanese classmates had written, "Go back to where you belong. I hate you. You smell like kimchi." And they wrote the words, "Die, die, die." And I could not forget these words. I could not. I didn't know what to do with these words, but I just kept them in my brain. And I could not believe that children, 13-year-old children, could hate other children so intensely based on one's ethnicity. An immutable characteristic this child did not have the power to change. I graduated as a history major, and then I went to law school because I am a very good immigrant. And then I got married. I was 24. And my husband and I bought a tiny but very beautiful little apartment in Manhattan. I finally had lovely clothes, and I worked in a beautiful office where everything smelled clean, and where the bathrooms were spotless, and the paper towel dispensers were always well stocked. Now, this may seem like a sort of weird thing to focus on, but when I think about going to the bathroom with my little sister at my father's store, where I had to stare down rats, I was incredibly grateful to work in an office like that. I practiced for 2 years, and I was a very good lawyer because I'm very anxious. And I always did my work very carefully. And then 1 month, I billed 300 hours, which means, and if you're honest, that means that you're in the office for almost 350 or more, because you can't bill every hour to your client. And after I finished a very important assignment, I walked to my managing partner's office to hand it to him, and then he immediately gave me another matter to work on. So I told him, without any plans, I can't do this anymore. And then I quit that day. I am pretty sure that if I had not known about my illness, I would have still been a lawyer today. And that I wouldn't have thought so carefully and so intensely about how to spend my time. My husband and I had $15,000 saved in our bank account, and I thought that I would write full time because surely it could not be so difficult to publish a novel. If only I had heard from Andrew then that the average salary is $5,000 a year in 2020. Perhaps I would still be thinking about more matters. It was not easy to publish a book. I was really wrong. I wrote a novel right away after I quit being a lawyer. And it was titled Revival of the Senses. And it was rejected by everyone. Revival of the Senses was even more pretentious than the title. So from 1996 to 2003, I worked on a novel called Motherland, and it was about the Korean-Japanese people. And the main character was Solomon, a Korean-Japanese who had been educated in America. And when I finished the book, I realized that it was dreadful, and I never sent it out. And at this point, I was terribly discouraged. And I was also very ill. After I had my son in 1998, I suffered from all these joint problems. I couldn't open doorknobs. I had trouble walking up and down staircases, and my wrists hurt all the time. And I was always tired. And after several misdiagnoses, it turned out that I had liver cirrhosis. My son was in preschool, so my doctor, Dr. Arthur Magan, said that I should try an experimental drug called interferon B. And I did. And for 6 months, I felt significantly sicker than from the symptoms of liver cirrhosis. I lost my hair, and blood vessels broke in my face every time I would bend down to pick up something from the floor. I vomited all the time, and I had such terrible diarrhea that I could not leave my house. I was always tired, and I had a few hours of energy every day, and I would save them for my son, Sam. But the drugs worked, and I am cured. My doctor, Dr. Magan, is a man who wears bow ties, and he is deadly skeptical of everything, and he said it was a miracle. From 1995, the year I quit being a lawyer, till 2003, I took classes for one evening a week at places like Literary Arts, at the 92nd Street Y, at the Gotham Writers Workshop, the Asian American Writers Workshop. I did not have an agent. To this day, I have a 3-inch binder filled with rejections for stories and essays. I thought about bringing the binder today, but I didn't want to check in a bag. I'm a writer. It's expensive. But remember the first thing that I had mentioned to you about high school. I was a great reader, and I still am a great reader. It is that identity that I still cleave to today. So I kept reading. I kept reading the very, very great novels. And one day, I read V.S. Naipaul's masterwork, A House for Mr. Biswas. And it moved me to weep on the subway when it was finished. It had occurred to me at that moment that I had already failed for such a long time, but I still cared about writing something really beautiful. No matter who I was, and no matter the consequences, it was still within my power to write about the people who fascinated me. And I wanted to write about the neighborhood in Elmhurst, Queens. So I wrote Free Food for Millionaires because I wanted to write about money, class, ambition, and how conventional ideas of such things may not hold up for those who are outsiders, for those who are different. I published that book in 2007, and then my husband got a job in Japan, and we needed the money. And I didn't want to live in Japan. It is a beautiful country, and all of you should visit. It has food better than France. French people say this. However, I didn't want to leave my family and my friends, and I didn't want to leave America. But I was pretty sure I could not get another husband. So I went to Japan. And in Japan, I decided to return to my second novel, Motherland. And I went to Osaka and I did field work. I met many Korean Japanese people and I interviewed them. And I learned that I had been wrong about everything. The Korean Japanese people had absolutely suffered institutional discrimination and they were deprived of human rights. However, they did not see themselves as victims. And this essential idea of how my subjects insisted on determining themselves made a very great impression on me. I took the manuscript that I had and I tossed it. And I had to rewrite everything from the very beginning. And I started again. I have failed for many more years than I have succeeded, if I have succeeded at all. In the past 2 years, I've been rejected for 3 teaching positions, 1 editor position, and 4 fellowships. As you may know, I was a National Book Award finalist. And for those of you may not know, is that the winner is announced on the evening of the awards. So I got dressed up and I invited my parents and my sisters and my in-laws, and my son flew in from California. My nieces and my nephews came, and I lost. It is a very specific feeling when everyone watches you as you lose. So, how do I stay a writer when I'm pretty sure I never thought that I could be a writer? Well, this is when I get to tell you about your superpowers and mine. I'm not sure if you know that you have these superpowers, but you do. You use them all the time. Perhaps you are a parent. When your teenager hurts your feelings, why do you still wait up all night for him to come home when you are bone tired? When your mother is cranky and needs you to take her to the doctor, but doesn't ask nicely, why do you leave work early so you can take her? And when your best friend calls you, crying on the phone, why do you stop making dinner to listen when you have half a dozen things left to do on your to-do list after dinner is made and after the dishes are washed and put away? Well, it's because you have a superpower. You know how to love when it is difficult. You know how to love and to do what is right when you are tired. You know that being different and being a statistical minority cannot be reason enough to give up. The parts of our lives that we love the most can be almost impossible to bear every day. But we bear it. We do it every day. And though our burdens are different, and though our wishes are different, we have this power to care and to persist because we know we must. and because we want our lives to matter. I want to thank each and every one of you for making books matter. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I want to make sure that we empower ourselves and the next generation to make things better. So thank you.
That was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. So we ask every writer to recommend some books. That's how we start things off these days. So the first one that I have on my card is you recommended Matthew Desmond's Evicted. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah. I think that if you haven't read this book, you're really in for a treat, because what Desmond has done is nothing short of astonishing. He has taken the crisis of housing inequality in this country, and he has given it a narrative and shape, and people and faces and stories. And it's really, really quick to read. It's deeply absorbing, as well as the fact that you learn so much about what's going on in the lives of people, people that we don't necessarily know. And hopefully, if you're not facing housing inequality, I do believe that this book is really beautifully written, and it's very powerful. It's actually a really good book club choice.
Catherine Boo, Behind the Beautiful Forevers?
Oh, another masterwork, I think. If you want to learn more about India and the lives of ordinary people in India, and even though people think that it only focuses on the poor of India, India, although it is developing a very strong middle class, it has incredible poverty for a highly literate society, and I think Boo did an incredible job in writing about the lives of ordinary people, and this one family in particular, in a ghetto. Mm-hmm.
This novelist is Canadian, so I'm just going to say that, because I'm Canadian. And it's not as well known here as I think he should be, but it's Rohatyn Mystery, and it's a novel called A Fine Balance.
It's a book that came out a while ago. Normally, I can't recommend a lot of fiction. I've been judging a lot this past year, as well as the year before, so I try not to talk about fiction, because it wouldn't be fair. So I tried to think of a book in the past 15 years. Is it about 15 years?
Maybe a little more.
Maybe a little bit more, where I think it's really stood the test of time. I think A Fine Balance is an incredible generational saga. Again, it's set in India. Wonderful to read. So sympathetic. And I think his comparison to Tolstoy is deeply earned. Hmm.
And the last one was Joyce Johnson, Minor Characters.
Oh, for those of you who haven't, this is a memoir. And Joyce Johnson, I believe she's still alive. I studied with her very briefly at the 92nd Street Y. And this novel, this memoir in particular is really special because she wrote about her brief affair with Jack Kerouac. So it does belong to the class of books where women are writing about sleeping with geniuses. There's a whole side of the library about that. But for my money, I think Joyce Johnson was the genius. And I hope that you get to read it, this memoir. It's really beautifully written, and it's a very powerful story of young love and what it means and how it changes your life. And it's a way to look at Kerouac again. I think the comparison probably is to A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway.
Hmm. How has your daily Bible reading, a trait shared with Casey in Free Food for Millionaires, influenced you as a reader and a writer?
Yeah, so when I first started writing, I didn't know what to do, and I read somewhere that Willa Cather, a writer I really love, read the Bible every day before she started writing. And I thought, that is so weird. And it's just weird enough and affordable enough for me to try it. So I started doing that. And now I still do it. Like, I read it 6 days a week. I have the NIV, which is the New International Version Study Bible, which is in large print because my eyes aren't very good. And I read a chapter, I read the commentary, and I read the chapter again. And how has this affected my work? I think that the reason why people have given me such generous comparisons to some of the classics in Western literature is because most of Western literature has been inspired by the Bible. So if you want narrative, just the book of Genesis, you're going to get about 1,000 novels from just the book of Genesis. I mean, it's all there. Incest, betrayal, murder, you know, competition, envy, greed, deceiving your brother. It's all there. So in terms of plot, it's a rocking good read. I know. As if God needed my blurb.
The New Testament quote, yeah, right on the jacket. Be great. What does being home mean to you? Where is home?
Oh gosh, you know, this is something that I've obsessed over, right? I mean, I had to write a freaking novel about it. I think that having been born elsewhere and then growing up in New York for most of my life, I really do see New York City as my home. It's the only place I have really felt like I'm normal, even though I'm so abnormal. And I'm not trying to exaggerate. I really didn't talk until I was 13. I didn't have any friends. I mentioned this earlier to the high school students. And I've had so many issues. But in New York City, all of my idiosyncrasies are very normalized because there's so many weirdos in New York. So I think New York is home to me. But I guess, to be frank, home is really where my family is. So I had a lot of difficulty in Japan because, not because there's anything wrong with Japan, truly, it's because I didn't feel at ease. Because I couldn't turn to my parents or my sisters and to my nieces and nephew and to my very dear friends. I have very old, like the friends that I have, because I didn't have that many, I cling to them because I could lose them and then I would have to make more, so.
Well, you said this afternoon, and I've never heard anyone say it this emphatically, that you loved high school. Like, I don't know anybody who loved high school. And I certainly didn't. Can you speak about that a little bit more? About why you like just so unambiguously loved high school?
Well, I didn't have any friends until I went to high school. And in high school, I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which is like the nerdiest school in the world. So I was right at home. And at the school, I did find a few people who were willing to hang out with me and eat lunch with me. That was exciting. Lunch is much better when you have friends, just saying. And also I felt like, even though I'm not a STEM person, I think at Bronx Science, I was really taught to think about the world and to test the world like a scientist. And even though I write fiction and nonfiction, I think very hard about proving things in my work. So I think that my science background as well as my legal background have made me want to test ideas and test theses, and that you see it in my work. I mean, that's why I'm probably never going to write a lot of books, because what I'm trying to do with fiction, I'm making arguments.
I made a lawyer joke earlier, but this is so clearly from a lawyer, I have to read it. I don't know.
My people.
What training or habits did you develop at law school and practicing law that help you in the writing process? That is a desperate lawyer in the room somewhere tonight. I don't know who you are. There's hope.
Yeah. It's from either my brethren or my sisters, I guess, in the law. I'm really organized. And I think that lawyers think in a very systematic, organized way about the issues. And as a matter of fact, sometimes I'm a little tough on my students not in their grades. I'm a really nice grader, but I can be a little tough on their drafts, where I say, tell me what the main issues are. And that's a very legal question. And I'll say, okay, so you're making this point. How do you prove it? Again, very legal. So in my work, at any point, I can almost drop a footnote and give you a citation. You're not gonna see it, but I can do it. And if you said to me, well, you said this thing here in chapter 2, but in chapter 52, this other thing happens, I could point to chapter 27 where I make the bridge. Like, I'm that schematic in the way I think, and I do think that's legal training. However, I did fail the bar the first time.
Do you have a favorite character in Pachinko, and do you see yourself in any of those characters?
Oh, yeah. People get really upset when I say this, but I'm in Portland. You are a city of counterculture. So I really like Hansu. And he's the gangster villain person. And the reason why I really like Hansu is because he's really sexy. And I talk to my writing students about this. It's really important that you have a character who makes happen when you're writing. So very often when you're writing, you identify too much with a protagonist. And then you have all these straw men characters around them. And the protagonist can always kind of knock them down very easily. So it's very important to have a very strong antagonist. So I always root for the antagonist. Otherwise, I'm not going to stand a chance in keeping your interest.
Has your family read your books, and how did they react if they did?
Yes, and they have read my books in English and in Korean. And in particular, most people want to know what my parents think, and they have liked it. It's incredibly gratifying to have my mother, who is not easy, say that she likes it. The first book, Free Food for Millionaires, after she finished reading it, she called me and she said, I liked it, but do people really have that much sex? And as you know, I've done a lot of research. So I said, yes, yeah.
It's funny because I had a research question here and I'm not asking that question. I think we're good. We might come back to it later or something. sorry. How do you know when a story is finished?
I think for me it's easier than other people because I begin with a very strong thesis. So once I have proved it, then I know that the structure is tight. If I know the structure is tight, then I know that the story lives. What is more difficult is that I keep polishing and polishing and polishing it until you just have something really plain. I work very hard on creating my style, which is very plain and unornamented. That's very intentional. I try really hard to take out every adverb. So if you read my work, it's one of those things you can actually test. It's like there are adverbs, but they're very few. And I do that on purpose because I'm trying hard to sharpen the verbs. And it's my thesis that you could really tell the quality of a writer by looking at her verbs. I know, now I've given you homework. Yeah.
Your writing has great empathy, sometimes for not so easily likable, maybe complicated characters. Have there been any of your characters you've had trouble empathizing with?
Yeah, there was one character, Charles, in my first novel. He's a character that my character Casey's mother, Leia, essentially falls in love with outside of her marriage. And then she falls in love with him not in a kind of like looking for an affair kind of way, but she just gets a full-blown crush as an adult woman. And Charles, who is the church choir director, who is a kind of hired and brought into the church, he's a failed artist, and he's not a good guy, or he does bad things. And I had really a hard time kind of getting in there. And at one point, I had to really try to figure out, why don't I like Charles? And I realized it's because, it's so obvious. It's because he was a failed artist. It wasn't because he was a bad guy or did bad things. It's because I think I didn't like being a failed artist. And once I had that, and was like, oh, and then I was able to love him.
We have time for one more question. What three people, living or dead, would you want to have at a dinner party, and why, and what would you eat?
I think I would choose comedians. And I love Robin Williams, and I'm so sad he's gone. So I think it'd be fun to, although probably be a kind of a crazy energy, but I really like John Mulaney. Who else? I love Ali Wong. Wouldn't that be a fun dinner?
Be crazy.
Yeah, crazy. It's a little crazy. I think I would just be really quiet and just kind of take it in. And also, I really like those things. So if I ever have, I like to cook, so I have dinners all the time. And when I do, I usually invite a lot of people because then I don't have to talk. Because I like kind of basking in their greatness. So I think that's perfect for me. I would really like to be around that much greatness, that kind of fast thinking, because I can't think that fast. What would we eat? I think something really caloric. Like nothing healthy. Like I would just pull all the stops and avoid all my carbophobia and just have like noodles and dumplings and stuff like that. Yeah. Like fried chicken for everyone, you know?
Thank you very much for coming to Portland and spending time with us.
That was Min-Jin Lee from Portland Arts and Lectures in 2020. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More on colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Ligori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.